This is John Van Eenwick, February 3rd, 1995. Individuation, blessing or curse?
Okay, thanks. The whole idea of psychological development from Jung's perspective is fascinating for a number of reasons. First of all, as you're all very well aware, it pertains to our own individual psychologies, and it's always nice to have a sense of why this stuff is happening to us and why our lives tend to frame themselves in the way they do, and why when we finally feel we've accomplished something with regard to psychological development, everything falls apart. We'll find out why that happens. But secondly, because groups have a psychology as well, and Jung's theories hold as well for groups as they do for individuals. And it's fascinating to look at any given group and see what particular dynamics are active at the time in its psychological development. For example, in our collective consciousness, if you will, our collective psyche here in the United States, what is going on and why. And at the end of this lecture and workshop tomorrow, you should be able to have a sense of just what exactly is going on and why, and what some of the pitfalls of it are, where it might most profitably go, and where it might most profitably avoid going. So that's one of the fascinating things about this whole relatively mechanistic view of psychological development that Jung talks about. What is individuation? Well, if you want a quotation, you can look in volume 4, paragraph 757, in which Jung says, "Individuation is the process by which individuals are formed and differentiated. That is, a process of differentiation having for its goal the development of the individual personality as a being distinct from the general collective psychology." An interesting kind of idea. And in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, he takes this up a bit and makes the statement that individuality and limitation are synonymous. So to the degree that we are individuals, we are limited. And it's within the context of the collective that potential opens up to us. And there is always a kind of ongoing dynamic between individual and collective throughout our psychological development. And as we'll see tomorrow, that collective exists both externally to us and internally. So tonight, in this introduction, which is sort of the cram course for the journey tomorrow, we're going to look at a number of things. We're first going to look at archetypes. Now, many of you may be kind of sick of archetypes. You've had a couple of lectures on them, a couple of workshops. You've heard everything there is to know about archetypes. Well, you haven't heard what I have to say about archetypes. So in order for us to clarify the language, it's not necessarily accurate that what I will be saying about archetypes is more faithful to Jung's idea than anything anyone else has said, but we need to get the language straight. So bear with me while we delve yet again into archetypes. Then we're going to look at, tonight, the synchronic dynamics of individuation. And I'll just write this word down for you so you have it in mind. Synchronic. As opposed to what we're going to talk about tomorrow, which is the diachronic dynamics of individuation. And it is absolutely impossible to understand the magnitude of what Jung was talking about without taking into account these two dynamics. And we'll get to that in a moment. Then we're going to have to talk about the transcendent function a little bit, and that's a very difficult concept mechanically or mechanistically to understand, because it has that kind of weird mystical quality of it, of the ghost in the machine that somehow produces something for us independently of our ability to really specify what that ghost is. But we'll get into that a little bit tonight too. Then we'll look at archetypal shadow, and I'll reiterate this when we get to that, but there are three categories of shadow that Jung talked about. The first is what would be called the personal shadow, and that basically is my shadow. It refers to the psychological counterpart of nouns, things. It's that aspect of me that is my shadow. Then he talked about collective shadow, and collective shadow is that aspect of the group identity, which is unconscious, which is not recognized as part of its identity. For example, those in our culture who buy into the myth of control and management and buy into the idea that we really can refine out of the system all of the tensions of opposites that create new meaning, will tend to project their own frustrations from within with regard to that group identity onto those people who symbolize to them everything that makes the system not work well. And we're going through that right now in our culture. For example, the big problem, one of the reasons our country isn't working right, is teenage mothers. Yeah, right? Sure, of course. Right. Well, if you look at that as a symbol, you can get a sense of what the group shadow is with regard to that whole issue. And that goes for any group. It goes for this group. Okay? We could talk about other psychological theories probably as aspects of our own shadow. Okay. Then finally, there is what Jung called archetypal shadow. And whereas personal shadow and collective shadow are nouns, archetypal shadow is a verb. It's a dynamic. And that is, what we're going to get into, the propensity on the part of the psyche to generate in a way that is recognizable by the ego the opposite of what the ego believes is real. So it's an ongoing dynamic which suggests that anywhere the ego takes a stand, the unconscious, through the archetypal shadow, a dynamic, will generate images in the environment of its opposite. Okay? And that's what we're really interested in tonight, the archetypal shadow, because it leads us into the world of symbols, and symbols lead us into the world of individuation, of transformation, of change over time. Diachronic means change over time. Synchronic means constantly repeating. Okay? We are part of the natural order. We are no different from molecules. We are molecules. Everything that is operative at the basic level of the mechanics of the universe is true for our mechanics of psychology as well. We see around us cycles all the time. We see the same sorts of things occurring all the time. The cycle of death and rebirth, for example, just in terms of the seasons. Here, it's not always as profound as it is in other parts of the country where it gets very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter. But we're all familiar with the cycles of the seasons that go on and on and on. Every year, they recur. Every year, the same cycle takes place. We go to sleep every night. We wake up every morning. We go through a wake-sleep cycle throughout our lives. We eat and we excrete. It's a cycle. We take in, we give out. Constantly recurring over and over. And yet, it certainly appears that as those cycles continue to be active, there is also a movement through time from something to something else. There's a really wonderful book about this called The Universe Story. I don't know if any of you have read The Universe Story by Swim and Berry. S-W-I-M-M-E and Barry. Fascinating account of the development, the diachronic development of the universe and our place in that process. But as these endless cycles simply repeat themselves in a relatively mindless way, something seems to be working that increases the level of sophistication of the overall picture as these cycles repeat. This is true for us too. So what are these cycles that are ongoing and always repeating? Well, we have to look at what goes on with regard to the way in which we learn, the way in which we see what's going on around us. And Jung had to create some concepts for that. One concept for that was already there, and he simply adopted it into his theory, and that was the concept of instinct. And he said, there are present at birth in the human animal, as well as all other animals, instinctual drives to do certain things, all basically in the name of survival. Eat, sleep, procreation, all of these are instinctual. They are the urges. They are the things that kind of get us started, so to speak. But then Jung added his own idea to that, and his idea was archetype. He said, okay, we have these basic drives. The organism knows somehow that it needs something. That's physiological. That's just at the basic level of chemistry. How does that awareness of its need get converted into an actual movement towards that which will gratify the need? There has to be some sort of psychological counterpart to the instinct that gives the instinct, or the organism experiencing the instinct, some idea of where to go, some idea of how to do something. And he said, that's the archetype. For those of you who like quotations from Jung, which I like, I'll read a couple. When Jung defined archetypes, he defined them as the deposits of constantly repeated experiences of humanity, a kind of readiness to produce over and over again the same or similar mythical ideas, recurrent impressions made by subjective reactions. If you want to look that one up, it's in volume 7, paragraph 109. And then he continues on. This is a quotation from volume 8, paragraph 435. He says, no biologist would ever dream of assuming that each individual acquires his general mode of behavior afresh each time. It is much more probable that the young weaver bird builds his characteristic nest because he is a weaver bird and not a rabbit. Similarly, it is more probable that man is born with a specifically human mode of behavior and not with that of a hippopotamus or with none at all. In other words, we are born with the capacity to experience things in certain ways. And that capacity to experience things in certain ways, Jung called the archetype. And what the archetype is a directioning, a redirecting, if you will, of psychic energy. The archetype simply takes our attention and places it somewhere else. Now, if we have an instinct, and the instinct's got to be gratified, it's the archetype that comes in the middle there and gives us a suggestion as to what we're going to do in order to get that instinct gratified. He says again, just as we have been compelled to postulate the concept of an instinct determining or regulating our conscious actions, so in order to account for the uniformity and regularity of our perception, we must have recourse to the correlated concept of a factor determining the mode of apprehension. It is this factor which I call the archetype, or primordial image. The primordial image might suitably be described as the instinct's perception of itself, or as the self-portrait of the instinct, in exactly the same way as consciousness is an inward perception of the objective life process. Just as conscious apprehension gives our actions form and direction, so unconscious apprehension through the archetype determines the form and direction of instinct. So, of course, you're all sitting there saying, well, all well and good, how does it work? Well, this is how it works. The archetype, which is attached to an instinct, has an affinity for objects which perception encounters. Of all the various things that perception encounters in any given moment of our existence, the archetype will attach a valence, a charge, if you will, to one or another of those objects, and we will be drawn to them. The child who needs to be fed has the instinctual urge to gratify its hunger. It is the archetype which will direct the child to the nipple, which will then activate the automatic inborn capacity to suck, and food will be obtained. Without that archetype there, as the infant's eyes roam throughout the environment, picking up everything, and the archetype says, it's that. and the infant goes for that. Without that, the infant would be at sea. And sometimes you can see that after having found the nipple, the infant will try to find numerous other things in the environment to try to gratify its hunger in the same way, and will pick up its toes, for example, and plunge them into its mouth, or its thumb, or numerous other things that we then immediately rush to the infant and rip away from them and say, no, you must not do that. This is because there's a feedback loop between perception and experience. The archetype, which directs our perception in the direction of a particular thing, then manages to lead us into a particular kind of experience. And once we have that kind of experience, that experience becomes associated in our mind with the archetype, with the instinct, and slowly our perception begins to define itself and differentiate itself. It becomes more sophisticated. It becomes better able to differentiate what's going on in the environment. Now, clearly, in order for this process to work, there needs to be one other component, and that component is consciousness. Consciousness is very useful for sorting out those mistakes that we make in responding to the call of the archetype, and also figuring out better ways of doing what the archetype is telling us to do. For example, we can create agriculture. We can figure out how to grow things rather than just relying on them to be in the environment. To understand this process, let's look for a moment at psychic energy. Psychic energy is an odd sort of thing for Jung, but it's absolutely crucial in terms of understanding how this whole phenomenon works. Jung says that psychic energy is a hypothetical, fundamental striving. Elsewhere, he describes it simply as life energy. It's simply that which animates us and gets us going. And he says, the concept of energy implies that of polarity, since a current of energy necessarily presupposes two different states, or poles, without which there can be no current. Every energic phenomenon, and then he adds in parentheses, and there is no phenomenon that is not energic. No phenomenon that is not energic. And of course, we know from Einstein that mass, matter, is just a form of energy. So that's been confirmed. Every energic phenomenon consists of pairs of opposites, beginning and end, above and below, hot and cold, earlier and later, cause and effect, etc. Consequently, says Jung, the psyche is characterized by differences in potential. Now, it might be useful to think of this in terms of a balance. And in the middle of the balance is a fulcrum. And at one end of the balance is the conscious or the unconscious, and the other is consciousness. Now, what Jung says is that there is a polarity in the psyche, just because that's the way energy works. It goes from one pole to another. It moves. And what it moves from is that area where there's a lot to that area where there's a little. So if you want to create an electrical flow and you create a supply of energy over here, of electricity, and there's a lack of energy over here, the energy will flow from the one pole to the other. We sometimes symbolize that by saying from the positive pole to the negative pole in terms of our electrical systems. Well, if in our lives consciousness becomes overly accentuated to the detriment of the unconscious, and we live a life that says there really is no such thing as the unconscious, it's all consciousness. We can really know everything about everything. And everything that we do know is, in fact, everything there is to know about everything. When that happens, consciousness is very, very large. It has a big potential in the psyche. The unconscious has a very small potential. So, if we're going to talk about psychic energy, what's going to happen is the archetypes will begin to draw the attention of the psyche, of the whole psyche, conscious and unconscious, towards unconscious contents as they appear in symbols in the environment. Correspondingly, if we have a situation in which consciousness is severely underdeveloped, so consciousness is a very, very small potential within the psyche, and the unconscious is absolutely huge, the archetypes will take psychic energy and direct it through symbols towards that which reinforces consciousness.
Can you give an example of a situation?
Yeah. Thank you. Sure. Absolutely. This is the situation at birth. This is the way we are as infants. This is the way we are as very small children. And what the psychic energy will do in terms of its movement, it will follow the archetypal draw towards consciousness. And consciousness, unfortunately, when we are little, tends to form, tends to become more active the more we are frustrated. So if I'm hungry and there's no food, and I begin to get animated over that, there will become a budding awareness in my consciousness, small and little as it is at that age, that something is not right. Something is not happening that needs to happen. And my energy will be moved into that aspect of consciousness that we call learning. I will learn, for example, that if when I am hungry I scream, the breast miraculously appears. And I will become more aware of that. Now, we talk about unconscious learning. And for a very small infant, that's kind of closer to the truth, because consciousness is not really sitting there in the form of a two-month-old saying, now, if I sit back and really scream and animate my body, they'll come. Consciousness is very, very small. But in the first stages of life, there is a constant flow of psychic energy into experiences that increase consciousness, primarily through frustration or the disparity between need and gratification. Well, round about midlife, says Jung, although for those of us who've had analysis, this can happen much earlier. We get a situation where consciousness has figured out just about all it needs to know, and our relationship with the unconscious is very bad. I'll go way out on a limb here and, you know, just sort of risk all of you getting up and leaving, but I would say that our culture right now is in this situation right here. We really believe that consciousness can solve every problem. We really believe that the difficulties that exist around us can be managed consciously. Consequently, psychic energy is constantly flowing into the unconscious. One of the interesting things that I've noticed about dreams over the years, you know how Jung used to talk about just before World War II, his patients were having all these dreams of blood flowing over Europe, all of this, and he said, ah, it's going to be a war. I have had, over the last 10 years, one of the most common dreams that patients bring to me is the toilet that will not flush. Isn't that interesting? Huh? And lots of people who are dreaming that they're sitting on a toilet out in the open. Well, of course, we all can understand that. I mean, there were times when we did. And those of us who were guys and went to grade schools and high schools where there were no doors on the cans and were constipated for 12 years, you know, because we held it until we got home. That was a problem. However, isn't it interesting that we have in our houses these things that take the waste material and flush it away where it's no longer in existence? And isn't it really kind of amazing how our culture as a whole seems to suddenly be waking up to the fact that it doesn't go away. It doesn't disappear. It doesn't get flushed into a black hole somewhere out by, you know, the earliest quasar. It gets flushed under the ground where it waits for us to discover it. Yeah? Look at the things that we attach the word management to. Forest management. Now, there's a thought. What are we discovering? Well, forest management. Well, where's the archetype going? We're getting all of these symbols of the fact that things aren't going the way we thought they were. We're losing entire species. Well, what's one species here and there? You know, we've always been losing species. And then we are drawn to the unconscious symbolism of the fact that we're one of the species. Very interesting. One of the phenomena that's going on in public health these days, my wife is a public health epidemiologist and keeps me apprised of all of these things, is that because of PCBs in the environment, sperm counts are plummeting. There are alligators in PCB-infested ponds whose penises are shrinking up to nothing. Potent symbol for us poor guys, you know. I mean, that's a very, very important part of our anatomy. And the idea of our potency dissolving away is a very interesting way of seeing that consciousness, into which we have put so much of our resources, right now is beginning to fade into the background when viewed against the symbols that are appearing in our environment that say that the unconscious is alive and well, very active, and we, folks, are being done to. That's the whole point of Jungian psychology. So those are the two examples that I would give at the moment, sort of life stage issues of the way in which this psychic energy flows. Let's see here. I got away from this. It's probably not that important anyway. So we're going to move on into the idea now of the kind of tension that exists inherently in the unconscious as a part of synchronic individuation. Let's just give an example of how this works. Let's suppose for a moment that there is in our psyche a whole raft of tensions of opposites. Jung says that tensions of opposites are that out of which all growth occurs. Without tensions of opposites, no growth. Very simple. So let's see in a very rudimentary way how this works. Here's consciousness over here, and here's the unconscious. And schematically, we're going to talk about the kinds of dynamics that exist in the psyche. Let's suppose that we have in consciousness a perception. And as most of us will probably realize, perceptions are very, very closely allied with assumptions. So in consciousness is a sacredly held perception based on an assumption, based on a whole psychological feedback loop of recurring experience and perception and experience and perception. And now we've got a kind of an idea in consciousness of what's going on. The unconscious, the archetypes, will direct psychic energy into the unconscious, into that area of our own psyche, which is its opposite. The opposite of the perception or the assumption will suddenly become alive within us. Now, of course, the first thing we do is project it onto the environment. And the first thing we do is believe that the environment is bringing to us something that is the opposite of our conscious assumption. We do that because, first, we really are not taught very much that there is such a thing as the unconscious. In my 27 years of formal schooling, except at the Jung Institute, nobody ever talked about the fact that there was such a thing as an unconscious. All we talked about was the stuff that was conscious. So, first of all, we're not even going to recognize this when it comes up inside ourselves. Secondly, as it comes up inside ourselves, the archetypes will select our vision of the environment around us and will valence, in other words, create a charge, either a negative repulsion or a positive attraction to something in the environment that symbolizes very well this opposite. We will perceive the within through the medium of the without, because it's difficult to perceive the within. Even when we do it directly through dreams, we usually do it through images that have come to us from without. And that's why, through projection, we tend to take this and see it in the environment, which means that if there's a psychological process going on inside me that is trying to develop me and help me to grow, and it's creating an opposition to what I think I am, the problem is you. Okay? And that's what we do all the time in our culture. Well, if I become aware of the fact, which I can hardly not become aware of the fact because this is me over here, that there is a perception and an opposition going on, in my conscious mind, I'm going to realize that there is a conflict. I will feel in conflict. Now, like de Maupassant's story of the Horla, if I can see that conflict as being a function of my environment and systematically eliminate everything in my environment that in any way represents that conflict to me, I can continue in the conscious idea that I can manage my environment. Unfortunately, as soon as we eliminate one projection carrier of the conflict, the archetype valences another. You know that wonderful story of the Horla where the guy finally burns down his house because there's this thing that's after him, and he just knows it's in the house. And he can't let anybody know that he's going to do this because the thing will find out. So he locks all the doors, locks all the windows, burns the house down. All of his servants are screaming as they die in pain in the fire. And he's blissfully free. And the last paragraph of the story, of course, is, I felt it again today. You know? As soon as we get rid of one projection carrier, the archetype simply valences another. If, however, we incubate the idea, in other words, we hold in our consciousness the idea that we are in a profound conflict, there's a real problem here. I don't know what to do. I can't handle this. I am at the mercy of this. I am inadequate to face this incredible conflict. What does the unconscious do? It constellates its opposite, which is resolution. Suddenly, and it's literally like that, suddenly it all comes clear. Suddenly something shifts. The resolution, as was the opposition, will suddenly appear in the environment. And that environmental appearance of the resolution will be symbolic. The archetype will simply valence something, the archetypal shadow, will simply valence something in my environment that says, this is the solution. Newt Gingrich, yeah? That woman over there, yeah? This school, yeah? This country, this vacation, advertising is built on this, yeah? We'll give you archetypal images of resolution. My wife and I used to live in Chicago. We lived in Chicago for 20 years. And it dawned on us one night that the news always started out with killings, rapes, you name it, horrible things. And the first set of ads would always be cruises and travel and vacations. You know? We began to wonder if there was a tie-in between those two, if perhaps the stories were actually the advertisements for the news, which was the advertisements. So, at any rate, if we are able to monitor either our environment and see the way in which the environment is constellating for us something of our own inner psyche, or if we're able to monitor our dreams and see in our dreams the way things are working out and the resolutions that are open to us, so we become consciously aware of the resolution and we bring it into consciousness, and the skies have cleared and the sun has come out and our lives are good again and we're back together with the person we kicked out of our house yesterday and everything is fine, what's the unconscious going to do? Well, it's going to generate its opposite, which is going to be conflict. And what the synchronic process of individuation is just, as Mark Twain said as his definition of life, one damn thing after another. Just when you think you've got it solved, just when you think you've got it, the opposite comes in. Yeah?
How would you compare this to the thesis, antithesis, synthesis?
Same.
Same thing?
Yeah. It's always been a mystery to me why Jung hated Hegel so much. You know, he's a classic Hegelian. I would say that probably 50% of what Jung talks about is Hegelian. But if you read what he says about Hegel, you know, inferior mind, the man never said a true thing in the world, you know, maybe it was just Swiss as opposed to German, I don't know, but it's very Hegelian, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because the Hegelian idea is itself archetypal. When you look at the way things are, everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Everything has one extreme, another extreme, and something in the middle. That is a dynamic whole. Structural whole, of course, is four. Dynamic wholes are three. And Edinger was the one who brilliantly came up with the way of integrating these two. This is off the lecture, but it's kind of fun. By saying that you can do a dynamic three that produces a structural four. You can draw a circle, you can square it and square it again, and you've done the three things that lead to the fourfold structure. And that's why this is such a powerful symbol. I've actually never found it to be a powerful symbol at all, but Jungians will tell you that that's a powerful symbol. So I guess I got the diploma. I have to say it. No, I'll go along with it. Now, there's a guy named Robert Nozick. I don't know if any of you are into Robert Nozick, but Robert Nozick is a philosopher, and he has made the wonderful statement that true rationality is always dissatisfied with itself. And that's what this is all about here. As soon as you do land somewhere, the archetype shows you where else you could be, and it's one damn thing after another. Parenthetically, as a priest in the church, I believe that if there is an afterlife, this is the best preparation for it. You know, if you can really get used to this process here, then when you die, one of two things is going to happen. Either there'll be nothing, and you don't have to worry about it, because you're just molecules with no consciousness. You're not aware of anything that's going on. Or it's going to be radically different from what's here. But if you're already used to what's radically different and can kind of function in that environment, then you might be able to handle it a little better. And that's where a lot of Jungians will talk about the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's exactly what the Tibetan Book of the Dead is talking about. That when you leave this life, you're going to need to have some sense of the relatively bizarre stuff that's waiting on the other side of whatever it is that gets us there. And if you're more in tune with that, if you're more conversant with functioning in that way, you'll make it. Of course, there'll be a tension of opposite there too, right? You know, I mean, yeah. Once you get to paradise, okay. Tension builds consciousness. Tension leads to growth. We have all been sold a bill of goods that says that paradise is a tensionless existence. No conflict, no tension. That is death. That basically is what we have been sold as paradise. I remember as a kid, fortunately in the Episcopal Church, we never had that kind of view of paradise. The Episcopal Church leaves all of this stuff blissfully undefined, and you can kind of figure it out for yourself. But I used to hear about the land of milk and honey. And I used to just think that was the worst possible thing that could be waiting for me after this life. Just sort of sitting around under trees with nothing to do all day. And I still sort of feel that way. So if there is a paradise, to me, it is the ability to go through this stuff with insight. It's the ability to have a sense that, here it is again, And it's not a function of that out there, which of course it often is. If I leave here tonight and somebody comes up to me with a .44 Magnum and puts it to my head and says, I'm going to blow you away, that's not simply an archetypal projection of my inner psyche. There really is something going on there, and I will have to deal with it. But if I'm used to that sort of stuff happening, perhaps the event will be a little more interesting, at least to me, than it might otherwise. And I might be able to, as I go from this life to the next, have the sense of, well, all right, this is where it's going to go. So this is where Jungian analysis gives you perfect peace. This process that we have been describing here of tensions of opposites and their resolutions is what Jung called the transcendent function. The transcendent function is a very, very interesting idea, and Jung said of it, it is a natural process, a manifestation of the energy that springs from the tension of opposites, and it consists in a series of fantasy occurrences which appear spontaneously in dreams and visions. Okay. We'll go on. As usual, von Franz gets it a little more down to earth. And she says, as you know, Jung called the symbol... that first quotation is from volume 7, paragraph 121. This is from... I don't have this reference because I don't have the bibliography. This quotation is probably from Shadow and Evil in Fairy Tales. That's most likely it. If it's not, call me, then I'll track it down for you and let you know what it is. If any of you have enduring questions that you just can't get out of your mind, this is the number to call. I will be happy to talk to you at your expense as long as you like. So if you need to get in touch, get in touch. As you know, Jung called the symbol-making function of the unconscious transcendent, for not only does it transcend our conscious grasp, but it is the one thing which, through symbol formation, enables man to pass from one state to another. We can assume in all of these quotations that the same is true for woman. You know, this is old writing. We would be forever stuck in an acquired habit of consciousness if this transcendent function of the psyche did not help us over into new attitudes by creating the symbol which shares in both worlds. The symbol is associated with both present and future psychic states and therefore helps us over. Jung and von Franz both, as is pretty much vernacular in the Jungian field these days, talking about a certain category of symbols which are called uniting symbols. And they basically unite opposites. They are symbols that are not so much there to get us to understand that there is an opposition going on. The kind of symbol that appears to us to draw us away from what our assumptions are into new potentials. These are the symbols that take the conflict that we have between where we are and where we are drawn and unite it in a way that creates a new place for us psychologically. I would love to give you an example of that, but the examples that I have of it don't really compute because it's a felt sense. It could be the same kind of symbol that you have in your dreams that to you really don't mean anything at all. But suddenly, for the dreamer, it's there. They've really found that spot, and it's kind of a felt sense. But what you feel in that place is that the old conflict, the old problem, no longer exists. This is why Jung, in some other places, says, we don't solve our problems, we outgrow them. And, of course, we've all taken that to be, here we go again. You know, obviously, when I was an adolescent and I read something like that, it was like, when you're old enough, you won't have any problems anymore. That's not what he meant. What he meant was we live beyond the conflict. We live through it and come out on the other side, and the issue isn't there for us anymore. It's just simply not a problem. We don't get hooked. You know, it doesn't hook us. It can be there. It can exist. No problem. We're fine with it. It's sort of like, I don't know why this image has been coming back to me. It's been coming back to me now for about a month, and it's of an old Kung Fu episode. You know, if you ever used to watch Kung Fu, I loved Kung Fu. It's great, you know. I mean, here was a very peaceful guy who beat the crap out of people every night on the episode. You know, what could be better? You know, he was very spiritual, pious, calm, centered, loving, embracing man who always was throwing people around in just incredible ways. But in this one episode, he had to undergo a killing. He had to be killed. And I don't remember the exact story. Those of you who are real Kung Fu addicts will know this particular episode. But what he had to do was, there was somebody who was threatening the town, and he was the sacrificial victim. We don't have any archetypal themes here, of course, right? And he had to sacrifice himself for the town, and if he didn't do that, the whole town was going to die. And what he did was, he meditated in a way that broke up the attraction between the molecules in his body. And he became a transparent self, so that when the person fired the arrow into him, it just went through without hitting anything. You know, it obviously punctured the skin. It obviously came out the other side and punctured the skin, but all the organs just sort of blissfully moved aside as the arrow came through. I think that's very much what resolving things at the level of the transcendent function is. You get to be so transparent to this stuff that it just goes through you. It's an Aikido approach. It's just not something you take on. And that's solving a conflict at the level of the transcendent function. It's not that you've really solved the conflict, but it doesn't exist as a conflict for you anymore. It doesn't hook you in. It's just there. Oh, okay, it's just there. Like Newt Gingrich. The man we love to hate. You know, I'd hate to not have Newt Gingrich around. He's Abby Hoffman, you know, used to say, if it's good theater, it's valuable, you know, and this guy is good theater. I think we've spent enough time on the transcendent function, and I'd like to wind this up in about 10 minutes, so I'm going to take off like a shot out of a gun here for a minute. When we talk about archetypal shadow, and we talk about that dynamic that automatically valences things that are contrary to what we believe is actual, you know, where we are psychologically, and this stuff gets valenced. Jung described this metaphorically in terms of a number of symbols. He said that the shadow and the opposing will are the necessary conditions for all actualization. Without this destabilizing aspect of our own psyches, we become flat. We just become dead. We achieve a level and we don't get beyond it. Now, of course, that never happens. So if we feel that we are in that position, we're either massively denying or we're allowing others to live it out for us. And, of course, that's one of the classic. The one who, as Jung said, keeps the creation from being just a piece of clockwork which the creator has to wind up to make it function. In other words, it creates an organic, evolving whole out of something that otherwise would just be a ticking thing which would just be always the same old, same old. In other words, it would just simply be a synchronic thing and nothing diachronic. What we're getting here is the idea that the archetypal shadow is not only a synchronic dynamic that constantly repeats itself, but it has intent. And that intent is informed by a design. And that design is the individuation of each one of us. Okay? So that as this stuff goes on, it's this Luciferian guy inside us who is constantly destabilizing everything we do. So as soon as we get to some place, something else opens up. This is especially true, you know, for like writing journal articles. I don't know if any of you have ever written a journal article, but as soon as you get to the end of the journal article, you realize all that you have yet to write. And eventually you just arbitrarily cut it off and say, that's it, I'm sending this thing in. You know, it's obviously not even remotely complete, and it gets published as something that is basically the introduction to what you want to do. And then you finally sit down and you write the book. You know, you write the whole book. You get to the end of the book and you realize that you haven't even begun to say what the book has led you to realize. Well, that's the ongoing thing. That's that Luciferian idea. And it's a struggle, because in order for us to evolve, we have to slough off the old. We have to allow ourselves to let go of all of that which we so valiantly fought to achieve. And as soon as we get there, we have to let go of it. It's a constant process of basically the goal receding another foot for every foot we gain toward it, that sort of a thing. And that's a painful process. And it's a struggle to wrest all of this new stuff from the old stuff, if only because of inertia. We get a kind of inertia to our lives that then interferes with all of this. The shadow, says Jung, is the creative urge within the self. He says, in its collective mythological form, so also the individual shadow contains within it the seed of an enantiodromia, of a conversion into its opposite. If you don't know this word already, this is one that if you ever go to a Jungian cocktail party, you've got to know. And you've got to be able to sling it around. It translates into alchemy, everything. You know, it's a real good word. Enantiodromia. And it means the conversion of something into its opposite. When something becomes its opposite. Okay? As we always say, it takes one to know one. We'll get into this tomorrow when we start talking a little bit about the shadow. I lived in a very small town, and we saw these all the time. You know, we could even predict them. We would see somebody getting more and more strung out on the righteous, pure life. And we knew that in a couple of months they were going to run away with a homecoming queen. You know, that it was just, you know, we just kind of wait and see it. So we were familiar with this thing. But when he talks about the seeds of the enantiodromia, the appearance of this enantiodromia comes into our lives in such a way that it is so disruptive that obviously it's going to be represented somewhere in folktale and mythology. And Jung said it is, and it's represented in what he called the trickster. And any of you who have read fairy tales and know about the trickster figure who's always throwing a monkey wrench into the works or always bringing something up that shouldn't be done, although it's not really a fairy tale because it didn't come out of the collective, Hans Christian Andersen's tale of, what was it, The Emperor's New Clothes. The little boy is the trickster. He's the one who says, I don't get it, he doesn't have any clothes on. You know, whereas everybody else is, oh, this is beautiful, this is wonderful. That's the enantiodromia, the opposite of the glorious majesty is really naked. And it's the child who's the trickster figure. Jung says the so-called civilized man, isn't that wonderful? The so-called civilized man has forgotten the trickster. He remembers him only figuratively and metaphorically when, irritated by his own ineptitude, He speaks of fate playing tricks on him, or of things being bewitched. He never suspects that his own hidden and apparently harmless shadow has qualities whose dangerousness exceeds his wildest dreams. As soon as people get together in masses and submerge the individual, the shadow is mobilized, and as history shows, may even be personified and incarnated. That's in volume 9-1, which is Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious, paragraph 478. Wonderful, wonderful quotation. What this all leads us to is the idea that when these processes occur, they occur in substance. Whenever the archetypes are active, they utilize substance to communicate their message. That substance is the content of what we call a symbol. And the compelling quality of the symbol is the archetypal valence that exists there. So that we live in a world of images that are messages, and they are messages about us. We live in a world in which both the animated objects and the inanimate objects are available to be used by our own inner process of psychological development to show us where to go, to show us how to go, to show us what to do while we're going. This is what we call symbols. Now, clearly, in our more or less mastery-oriented modern Western way of looking at symbols, we try to figure them out. We even have symbol dictionaries that will tell us what symbols mean. And of course, the best symbol dictionaries don't tell us what symbols mean. They simply tell us what they mean to other people. And then we can figure out for ourselves what the symbol means. But figuring out what a symbol means is never an act of specificity. It's an act of relationship. Jung talks about this in a couple of places. First quotation is pretty good. The second one I absolutely love. He talks about symptoms. Symptoms are the psyche's way of telling us that something is going on. Okay? Now, clearly, if I walk out of here tonight, slip on the stairs, break my leg, that's probably less an archetypal indication of something I should be recognizing other than the fact that maybe I'm just trying to go too fast and not really looking what my standpoint is. I mean, we can view everything symbolically. But if I start getting a cold, if I start getting pains in certain parts of my body, that symptom is trying to tell us something about our psychological orientation toward life. In volume 14, paragraph 505, Jung says, "When the conscious assumptions become unworkable, and if neurotic symptoms appear, then the attitude of consciousness, its ruling idea, is contradicted. And in the unconscious, there is a stirring up of those archetypes that were the most suppressed by the conscious attitude." And then he goes on to say, in the next paragraph, that was volume 14, paragraph 505. And 506, he really talks about how we are supposed to deal with the conflicts that symbols present to us. It's a beautifully phrased quotation. "The unworkable conscious dominant disappears in menacing fashion among the contents rising up from the unconscious, thus bringing up a darkening of the light. The warring elements of primeval chaos are unleashed as though they had never been subjugated. The battle is fought out between the dominant consciousness and the contents of the unconscious so violently that reason would like to clamp down on unreason. But these attempts fail and go on failing until the ego acknowledges its impotence and lets the furious battle of psychic powers go its own way. If the ego does not interfere with its irritating rationality, the opposites, just because they are in conflict, will gradually draw together." Sort of like the boxer's clinch. Yeah. and what looked like death and destruction will settle down into a latent state of concord, suitably expressed, as he says, by the symbol of pregnancy. And our typal content, he says this in paragraph 267 of 9.1, Archetypes and Collective Unconscious, and our typal content expresses itself first and foremost in metaphors. If such a content should speak of the sun and identify it with the lion, the king, the hoard of gold guarded by the dragon, or the power that makes for the life and health of man, it is neither the one thing nor the other, but the unknown third thing that finds more or less adequate expression in all these similes. Yet, and this is important, to the perpetual vexation of the intellect remains unknown and not to be fitted into a formula. What I would like to do now is take a break. I mean, you know, you've been listening to this very patiently and graciously for quite a while. Let's take a break. We'll come back. I will sum up in about 5 minutes, and then we'll open it to questions. Okay? So take a break, relax, digest. My habit to not be offended by people who leave. So if, as we start asking questions, there are things you'd really prefer to do on a Friday night, feel free just to get up and go. And those who, you know, have compelling questions and want to ask them will stay, and we'll do this until 9:30. So don't feel you're being rude. There are generally, and this is something I'm sure that all of you are very aware of, there are generally two ways of looking at symbol interpretation in the Jungian model, and one of them is also generally disparagingly associated with Freud, while the other is generously ascribed to Jung. And the two ways of looking at symbols are reductively and constructively, or a reductive interpretation and a constructive interpretation. The analogy is not fair. Freud was not a reductivist. He was very much more than that. There was a certain sense in which he did stop in his interpretation, possibly a little short of where he could have gone, and Jung felt that he kind of moved beyond that. There's a sense in which the followers of Freud became real solid reductive interpreters, because we live in a world where specificity leads to funds, leads to finances. So the more one can specify what something means, the more one can kick out the funds. I was in a conference in the Philippines in December on torture from this very small group of people all over the world who deal with this issue. And one of the big issues was diagnosis. And I was in one workshop, and a friend of mine from England was a psychiatrist, and very, very strident about his feelings that DSM-4 is not applicable to cultures other than European and American, and should not be used because it's an arbitrary cramming of other psyches into this. I said to him, well, Derek, the problem with that is if you can diagnose PTSD, you can get funds. You can get millions of dollars of grants. What are you going to substitute for that? And of course, that's the rub, because you could come up with an absolutely generic definition that evolves totally out of the culture you're looking at and bring it to the U.S. Congress, and well, people haven't a clue as to what you're talking about. So reductivism is something that is valued in our culture. So obviously, if you want to become in a position of power, if in the world of the politics of ideas you want your idea to be implemented, boom, there you are. Now, to my way of thinking, one of the interesting things that's happening in science these days is that we're going from a lot of reductive interpretations of things to more constructive interpretations, particularly with regard to the difference between the old mechanistic type of cause-effect views of the world to the more the views that basically believe that everything has to fall apart in order for it to come back together in a higher form, what's sometimes called chaos theory, which I'm very, very interested in. And that then leads to a much more constructivistic view of events and mechanics. But a reductive view of a symbol is to say, this symbol means this. I have a knife. A knife is a phallic symbol. That's the kind of symbol it is. It's a phallic symbol because it cuts. It can be a weapon, an instrument of healing, an analytic tool, or even a phallic symbol. It can be equated with masculinity, phallic in its ability to probe, cut through, augment personal power. But if you choose any of these meanings, you disregard the others. And the fact is, if you dream of a knife, the only way you can really understand what knifeness is to look at the appearance of the knife in every venue where it's symbolic. You have to know everything there is to know about the knife. So that rather than taking a phenomenon and boiling it down to its salient point or to that aspect of the phenomenon which seems to inform the total phenomenon to the greatest degree, so that a knife is a phallic symbol, what you do is you take the knife in all of its appearances everywhere. And once you've got all of its appearances, you get a kind of sense of what the entire composite image is. And unfortunately, that is rarely, if ever, expressible rationally. It's a felt sense. It's a relationship with the totality of the phenomenon. And what this means is, and this is absolutely crucial, that the analytic process exists, at least in the beginning, at least in the first 10 years, primarily to bring consciousness into the world of the unconscious, where there are no lines, there are no borders, there are no specificities, and for consciousness to begin to think in those terms, to begin to be able to feel, if you will, or intuit, if you will, or constructively ascertain various phenomena in its life, is to become more like the unconscious. Now, the second part of analysis, which is the next 10 years, twice a week, $100 crack. Remember that, it's important. 20 years, okay. We'll all be expecting you to call. The next part of analysis is where consciousness learns to negotiate with the unconscious, where consciousness begins to, like Abraham and God, stand up to the unconscious and say, I understand. I understand what you're trying to do. But it would be better for me if we did it this way. And that's the kind of cooperative rapprochement that's looked for in the conscious-unconscious relationship. So that it's absolutely ridiculous to take as our infallible cue everything that comes from the unconscious. That's bizarre. That's to go back to a state of infancy. But in order to listen to the unconscious and have a sense of what it's saying, we have to live in the country for a while. We have to learn the language. So, for example, I was doing a dream group this morning, and this is another thing. I'm getting a lot of dreams of violence these days, of personal violence and people being attacked and that sort of thing. And we had one dream where the woman dreamed that she was consolidating some of her luggage on a street corner, and an army vehicle came down the down the street, and she realized they were coming for her, so she ran and she got to her house just as a soldier arrived, and she managed to get the mace out of her pocket. She carries mace. And she managed to get it sprayed into the soldier's eyes. And then later on, because she knows a bit about this process, she did an act of imagination with a soldier and said, what do you want? And the soldier said, I want your sweetness. And she said, why? And he said, because that's what runs our trucks. Well, you know, welcome to the world of the unconscious. You know, you try to, you know, reduce that, if you will. Oh, well, what that means is, you know, it's like... So I was saying to her, imagine what the soldier must have felt being in your unconscious. Because the unconscious knows that in a dream, when it kills you, you don't die. So if you begin to think from the perspective of the unconscious, you see that there's a whole different way that the dreams put themselves together because they play different rules. one of the things we do with torture survivors a lot is teach them what those rules are so they can then begin to dream the dreams onward that they have, which are usually nightmares, and begin to put together scenarios that are, you know, as loosely based on reality as the nightmares are. So to begin to understand what the unconscious is doing is to become more of a constructive interpreter. That's about enough for today, for tonight. Tomorrow what we're going to do is we're going to get into the diachronic aspect of individuation, which is once this stuff gets trucking along, once the juggernaut gets moving, where does it go? And what are the stages that it goes through? And how does it get there? And where is it trying to go? And how can we recognize what's happening? And what are the various functioning capacities that occur? If there is intent in the psyche that exercises a design, what are the agencies? What are the various agencies in the psyche which affect that design through their intent? That's what we'll do tomorrow. So those of you who would like to go and have a joyous and happy partying Friday night, feel free. And those of you who would like to ask questions, go ahead. Yeah?
I have a question about how all of this applies to the creative process. It sounds very similar, but if you could say just a little bit about the creative process.
The creative process as what? Creative process as experienced how? I mean, what like when we paint or sculpt or write or?
Yeah.
Boy, that's a book. That's a lot. I feel like Beavis and Butthead here. You know? Little thought balloon with nothing in it, you know, that kind of thing. For me, personally, the creative process has always been a process by which I was able to articulate the limit of what I was able, and then had to wait for something to dawn on me, something to come, you know, the writer's muse, or, you know, the wonderful idea of liberating the form from the sculpture, and just being able to kind of sense it and see it appear before your eyes as you do it. Creativity has become for me something that I don't have a lot of control over. It just sort of comes, and all I do is decide what I'm going to do and what I'm not going to do. So in terms of tensions of opposites, what usually happens is once I've reached the limit of what I understand, and I'm helpless, there's nothing to fill the vessel, so to speak, that's when the unconscious tends to kick in. But it doesn't really kick in until I've gotten to that point. Does that help at all? I feel that's a horribly inadequate answer to your question. Okay. Yeah, ask again tomorrow if you want. Or, you know. What is that sound, by the way?
My guess is they're using a floor buffer upstairs.
A floor buffer, oh, okay. I thought they were having a dance. I thought, well, the Senior Citizens Center is really quite lively tonight. That's pretty great. Any other questions? If there are no more questions, you get out early. Yeah?
I am interested in the concept
of evil. So am I. What do you got in mind?
It's hard to get a handle on it, but I guess it's like all of this is necessary, and the conflicts and the crisis are always balancing and growing as we move forward. But where does it sort of fall off the edge as we get into the stuff that I'm hearing people say, this is really evil? Because there's part of me that resists that concept altogether, and yet there's another part of me that says, I think we might look at this, and I would like to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay.
Where evil comes
where evil tends to come in, from my perspective, is in projection. In actually not seeing through our projections, or that's not even really evil. The unwillingness, the refusal to see through our projections, I see as being evil. The refusal, the conscious refusal to listen to what the environment is telling us, I see as evil. The willing acquiescence to someone else's getting caught in our complexes, in our individuation process, and getting ground to dust in it, and our avoidance of our own conflicts through letting someone else live them out, I consider to be evil. Evil, I think, is the intentional infliction of suffering on another person where it has no positive outcome. Say, I mean, we obviously inflict suffering on people all the time because we feel it's going to be good for them. You know, this, you know, the kind of thing of, okay, I'm going to assign a 30-page paper over your vacation. You know, that's an infliction of suffering on somebody. But obviously, we feel that it's going to make them a better functioning person. But for me to say, I refuse to deal with that part of my unconscious that has no expression in my life because I work 14 hours a day. So my kids, if they get involved in drugs, then that's their problem. That to me is evil. And that's failing to listen to what's coming to me. It's failing to create enough place in my life for a dialogue with the other aspects of my life in a way that forces me to listen. I would say that's where evil really comes in.
What about the notion of not being ready yet to listen?
Yeah.
To be aware of it.
Yeah.
And if you're not ready to, is that really evil?
Heavy question. Tough question. If you're not able to listen, if you're not able to understand the kind of information that's being given to you, is that evil? My impression is that the kind of information that is communicated to us that we are not prepared to hear because we're simply just not there yet is never very profound information. Because if it is, people will scream it in our ears. I mean, the whole environment will just yell at us. And particularly with regard to families, our kids, our spouses, will tell us. And if we refuse to listen, that's getting into a conscious avoidance of the unpleasantness of the task, of beginning to pry ourselves away from our point of view. And that, I think, is evil. It's a tough question with regard to evil. I like religion better when it comes to evil. You know, I think religion has a much better sense of what evil is than psychology. Yeah.
One religious perspective on evil is the Hindu perspective, which pretty much just says that evil is ignorance.
Evil is ignorance, right.
But in modern society, the most evil people that I see in the news seem to be sociopaths, which is, you know, a Western psychological construct.
Right.
But it also defines an evil person pretty well.
Right.
What's your perspective on the sociopath and his relationship to consciousness, or lack thereof, legends of unconsciousness, I guess? Is he just someone who's totally unaware, or what is...
I don't know.
What does a sociopath look like to you?
What do they look like to me? They look like people who are totally devoid of eros. I like Guggen Buell Craig's take on sociopathy, which he wrote a book called Eros on Crutches. And he talks about the sociopath as being absolutely devoid of connectedness, of relatedness, cannot connect, cannot relate. The question then becomes, okay, is that evil? That's a tough one, because if the person is, as the Hindu idea, just totally ignorant of what it is to relate, or if there's a biochemical reason for that, which apparently there is some research in the field that feels there is, that it's the lack of a certain neurotransmitter. You know, if all else fails, it's serotonin, right? You know,
where a lot of people feel it's the lack of cuddling or similar things.
Right,
that,
right. Awareness of the consequences of one's behavior, as far as I'm concerned, do not rely on eros. They do not rely on relatedness. And a complete disregard of the consequences of one's behavior when it negatively impacts somebody else in a way that has nothing constructive for them is, to me, evil. So that's where I take on sociopathy. And the question is, how do you treat it? Well, that's a whole other question.
You mentioned Guggen Buell Craig. Probably in that same book, he made the observation that he was not amazed that there were so many sociopaths in government. He was more amazed that there were any non-sociopaths.
Never forget he's a Swiss.
But, to some extent, that's true, because the power attracts the sociopath. And the more powerful the government is, the more attractive it is to the sociopath. How does that play out in a Newt Gingrich society of devolving governments?
You want to give me a shot when I leave here tonight? I mean, you know, the walls have ears, you know. I mean, I just said to somebody today, for the first time in years, I've actually thought I should be careful of what I say. The old paranoia is creeping back in. I don't think that sociopathy and government go together at all. I really don't. I think that most of the people who serve in government really do, they are very connected people, and they really do care. Unfortunately, they are subject to the most massive projection systems any society can put on them. And the problem is that some of them start identifying with the projection. That's the real problem for all of us, is identifying with the projection. And when that happens, you become inflated, which means you are more than what you really are. And when you become more than what you really are, you do lose contact. You do lose that kind of connectedness. I think, I've known a number of politicians. I've had a couple of politicians in analysis, and they're very related people. Very, very, well, of course, the ones in analysis would be, right? I mean, it's the ones who don't come into analysis who probably aren't.
The ones in the state of Washington, which, of course, is who you see down in Olympia.
Well, no, this is out of Chicago.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Should we be thanking our sociopaths for being our shadows and making us evolve?
Ah, good question. Would you rephrase that again? Say it again.
Should we be thanking the sociopaths for being our shadows and making us evolve?
Yes, absolutely. Should we be thanking our sociopaths for representing our shadows and making us evolve? Yeah. It's an interesting sort of thing in some of the Asian cultures, again. A friend of mine, a very wonderful woman, was an alcoholic for 20 years, just a real raging drunk, and she's been dry now for about 30. And she's an alcohol counselor and a very wise woman from Tennessee, and she used to be in my congregation on Friday mornings in one of the churches in Chicago that I worked in, and we would always go to breakfast afterwards. And she was amazed when she went to Japan that people who had become drunk and passed out on the street, people would walk up and bow to the person and move on, sort of just a real, and she asked about that. And it was that this is where the person is, and this is something that we need to see. But what they have to work out, they have to work out. And it was a real honoring of that sort of phenomenon. I think that's honoring the projection carrier.
In Western society, there but for the grace of God go I.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, right. Well, actually, I think in Western society it would be there go I out of my awareness. Beyond the limit of my awareness, that is I. I know what that is. There were some questions over here that I haven't. Anyone? Yeah.
How do you structure the workshop?
How do you structure the workshop? I don't know. They're always different. We're going to start at 1. I know that. I'm real intuitive. What I'm going to do is I've got some notes on what individuation is as a linear-type diachronic process as explained by Jung in Volume 7. And what we're going to basically do is talk about what the various components... Is this what you want to know? When you say, how do I structure the workshop? What's the format going to be?
Yeah.
Well, I would prefer more discussion. Yeah, that we kind of kick the stuff around and I throw out and I give you some sense of what we're talking about and then you feedback. And it depends on the size of the group, Okay, thanks. Right. Yeah.
Unless I've read you wrong, what I'm hearing is you're saying there's an inherent balance in the whole system between the conscious and the unconscious, and once one becomes inflated too big, it gets balanced out from the other side.
Right.
So then could we say, looking at a world view from your point of view and how you see Jung, from a world point of view then, all the horrendous things that we seem to be seeing happening in the world right now, the violence in our children, whatever, will, this one back here asked part of the question for me, but will we inherently probably see that balance out over a period of time?
Not if we don't do anything about it. Not if we don't do anything to try to find out what our contribution to that phenomenon is. And I mean your contribution. I mean my contribution. If we don't do that, no, it's not going to balance out.
How do you see that happening?
How do I see us doing that? Well, that's pretty tough. That means investigating those aspects of our lives that basically tried to eliminate violence. That's the first thing. The second thing is by talking to the people who are the violent people, by engaging in a dialogue with it. And finally, by understanding what our violence is that we practice every day that we conveniently don't have to see. How are we violent? Back in the 60s, the phrase used to be, poverty is violence. You know, that sort of stuff. How do we practice violence? How do we violate other people in such veiled ways that we don't even see it? That's when violence begins to be adjusted. When people start talking about, you know, if you want peace, work for justice, they're right. That's absolutely the key thing. Because violence comes out of injustice. It comes out of impotence and powerlessness. And now I'm getting into my next conference presentation, which is in Chicago in May, where I have to go and talk on violence. So I've got a lot to say about violence. Lived fairly close to violence a lot. So yes, absolutely. If we refuse to recognize our contribution to it, then no, it won't readjust. What will happen is the message will get louder. Right. Yeah?
Didn't you say that you cannot force individuation?
Right.
So that, does that persist as far as how much we can push for our consciousness?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. The two things we can do, though, first of all, in terms of forcing individuation, we certainly can't force others to do it. But we can jump into it with both feet ourselves. And Jung also believed that to the degree that you alter yourself, you alter the whole field, which is also a very Asian, actually it's a very religious thing. I mean, there's not a religion in the world that doesn't believe that. So we can do that. In terms of avoiding the pitfalls as we go along, probably the most important thing about individuation for us to learn is that the majority of the dilemmas that we find ourselves in are not something that we have to feel we personally created. They are created for us to learn. So we don't have to try to avoid taking responsibility for it by not admitting it's there. We can admit it's there because it's something we've got to listen to, and we didn't create it. We had something to do with it, but we didn't create it. And the other thing is not to project it onto other people as being the cause of it. That's one of the most important things. Please.
You know, you brought up something in my mind, you know, that we spent a lot of time in public policy, like the kids and drugs, and with their programming. Well,
yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of the... Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. Yeah, I mean, look at the whole drug scene. I mean, if anything, it's big business, first of all. Well, what do we worship in this country more than anything else? You know, turning a profit. I've wanted to put a bumper sticker on my car that says, screw the environment, give me money, you know. And just, but as my daughter pointed out, you know, Dad, they're going to shoot you. And I said, yeah, right. That's, children are wonderful. You know, as you get older and looser, you know, they kind of help you to tighten up a little. Yeah.
I wondered if you must have thought about this because you mentioned you're preparing to do a presentation on violence. If you would go back to your fulcrum, you know, with the conscious and the unconscious, and talk about how the energy moves. Since 1991, I've been practicing a lot on the
health. Yeah.
And have you noticed how after the war was over and the big celebration and the big victories, there was not much mention of it anymore, other than in the campaign.
Right. But Persian Gulf.
No mention of it. A few books out, but most of the books out have to do with the history of Iraq and how the Gulf War was, you know, speedily executed and all that. I wondered if you would comment on, in terms of that fulcrum and the movement of the energy. You know, my sense of it is, it's just that we haven't dealt with it at all. there was so much projected onto Saddam Hussein, almost classically by George Bush, then, and by the rest of it. And then, no word of it. Yet. No one's talking about it. It's as if we dealt with that now. Plus, in 1994, the U.S. government and the Pentagon said, it's our goal. No other nation in the world will be able to be any rival to us militarily. We will be preeminent. I mean, that's a white paper, so to speak. So, anyway, I wondered if you could just reflect on that in terms of your fulcrum and the movement of the energy and the unconscious.
I was going to say, you people really ask questions. I mean, this isn't like, could you redefine tension of opposites? I mean, this is like cosmic stuff. I could go on and on about that. I could go all night on that, as I could on drugs. I mean, you know, the whole drug thing to me is just so patently obvious. But being an extroverted intuitive, I obviously think I know everything anyway, right? People used to say to me, you lecture with such conviction, you know. How do you do that? I said, type and function, you know. Extroverted intuitives can just stand up and say anything, you know, and it's true. Whereas if you're a sensei, you might actually check it out, you know. And that could get you into trouble. So that's what it boils down to. I think the Gulf War, particularly, was about resources. And this whole military thing is a very, very interesting thing, because when we talk about being able to fight two wars at once, we're basically talking about, and we've made this very, very clear in Bosnia, we're talking about preventing anyone from denying us their resources. And that, very interestingly, is going on at the same time that our economy is going through a massive shift. What is the nature of that shift? What's happening in our country today with regard to employment? What kinds of jobs are disappearing?
Industrial jobs.
And what do industrial jobs rely on? Resources. And oil and all of that kind of stuff. And we're not facing that issue at all. We are absolutely not facing the issue of the degree to which we are gearing up to make sure that we have an absolutely unobstructed supply of other people's stuff. And as we do that, the rest of the world markets are slowly undermining us in ways that are, as to my way of thinking, this gets hallucinatory, identical to the Vietnam War. Where, as several of the Vietnam generals said, North Vietnam generals said after the war, the problem was the Americans was they could fight beautifully at a distance, but up close they couldn't fight at all. And that's where we got them. When we got within 3 feet of them, we won. And that's what they just, you know, all the underground tunnels, everything was. And it's just that huge shadow thing. You know, what's the gap? What, you know, we're pouring resources into this stuff and we're not seeing the gap. We'll talk. I want to make sure everybody else gets it. Yeah. This is really irresponsible speculation on my part. This is not good, sound clinical psychological judgment. You're asking me to sort of pontificate, and I'm doing it. This is the entertainment section of the evening. Yeah.
That's good. That'll help with this question. You have the fulcrum there, and the conscious and unconscious, and a lot of people, I would imagine, and religions, particularly, try to seek ways of finding unity with the universe or with God or whatever. And I'm wondering how those two things relate. How does that happen?
Unity and...
Well, you described the conflict resolution back and forth.
Oh, okay.
Something is always going on.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of the human desire to be at unity or one with whatever they project, I suppose.
Gee, I'd love to answer that question, but we're almost out of time. You know, I knew when I came down out of the mountains and came into Babylon, it was going to be a tough experience, but I had no idea. Boy, I haven't been in Babylon in years. Yeah, the tension of opposites is, I think, sometimes most easily understood in terms of paradox, that all truth is paradox, and there is no truth that is not paradox, and there is no paradox that is not true. So if, and that's the constructivist approach, so if anything is not paradoxical, it's not accurate. it's if it's not taking into account the paradoxical, the fact that its opposite is at the same time also true, then it's not true. For example, with regard to unity, not so much unity with the divine, which of course we're all seeking, but I think this could also be interpreted in that way, but unity with one another. The only way we can have unity with one another is by absolutely valuing our diversity. You know, the only way I can be at one with you is by totally valuing your differentness from me. And then we can be together. Then we can be at one. And I think we are reflections of the Creator. And the Creator is a multi-diversity type phenomenon. And once we narrow anything down, we lose that with which we're trying to gain unity. So once we try to specify that with which we are seeking unity, we've lost it. See, that kind of thing. And that's very religious. That's a prime religious thing, you know. What is God's name? I am the I am. Oh, okay, you know, fine. You know, and Yahweh, you know, it's the unpronounceable. No one has seen God. It's all through all the religions. Don't try to specify what you're trying to get to with regard to that, because as soon as you do, you've lost it. And then, of course, you ask yourself, well, where does that leave me? You know, and the answer to that is at a profound variance with your culture. And that's where you get all the stuff in Christianity. We are not of this world.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.